So good evening, and welcome to our study of the life divine. Tonight, we open chapter 27, the sevenfold cord of being, which first appeared in October of 1916, but which was probably written in the middle of September, about this time. Sri Aurobindo has made some significant additions to this chapter and inserted a clarifying or constellating word here and there. For instance, he has taken the opening citation again and expanded it. Originally, it was just a fragment taken from this hymn in the Rig Veda, from the first mandala, the famous 164th hymn. This was the fifth verse. And he printed in the Arya, "The all-knowing gods have woven wide seven threads to make this weft." Now you can see that he's taken basically the whole of the fifth verse, the Rik, and he's translated in this way. "In the ignorance of my mind, I ask of these steps of the gods that are set within. The all-knowing gods have taken the infant of a year, and they have woven about him seven threads to make this weft." The infant of a year is a calf, symbolizing a cosmos which has been born and which will grow and expand as it grows. But seven threads signifying symbolically all the worlds that are contained within this calf, which will find their natural expression as he lives. The sevenfold cord. Again, cord, which has a musical connotation to us. A number of notes harmonically playing to simulate in vast form what cannot be expressed from that timeless absolute. And still, the form is significant, and still the harmony is meaningful, even if it can't capture all of what is above in that unknowable. Still, this being positively portrayed here is harmonious. And now you'll see as we go through, this is a wonderful piece of architecture that Sri Aurobindo has written here. And he, to draw from Savitri, which we read last time, this is a compendium of the vast. This chapter summarizes all the principles of being and how they are stationed one upon the other, involved each in the other. So, let's begin and enjoy this as we go. It's rather a short chapter, but we'll still spread it out over 2 weeks. We have now, by our scrutiny of the seven great terms of existence, which the ancient seers fixed on as the foundation and sevenfold mode of all cosmic existence, discerned the gradations of evolution and involution, and arrived at the basis towards which we were striving. So the seven great terms of existence, the ancient seers, this is again an allusion to the Vedic reference above. This is not the only place in the Vedas where the seven rays are spoken of, or the worlds are depicted in this kind of symbolic order. It occurs and recurs. Sri Aurobindo has seen that at this basis we find an involution that arrives at the incipience of a cosmos and an evolution that results from that involution. We have laid down that the origin, the continent, the initial and the ultimate reality of all that is in the cosmos is the triune principle of transcendent and infinite existence, consciousness, and bliss, which is the nature of divine being. So again, he asserts that Satchit-Ananda is the positive manifestation of that unknowable. Existence, but existence which is not unaware, existence which is fully aware, infinitely aware. A bliss which is borderless, which is unmitigated, which we can only describe in the negative because nothing positive can stick to it, because it is an absolute self-experience of the absolute within its infinite consciousness. Consciousness, he writes, has two aspects, illuminating and effective, state and power of self-awareness, and state and power of self-force. So consciousness is not simply a passive witnessing. Consciousness is full awareness, but it is also filled with power. He continues, by which being possesses itself, whether in its static condition or in its dynamic movement. So it is always possessed in its awareness. It is never lost in the movement. When it is wrapped in stasis, unmoving, it is not limited only to that. And when it releases itself into movement, it is not engrossed to the point of self-oblivion. It is always and fully aware of its own nature. Consciousness does not get lost by the application of force and by movement out from stasis into dynamism. For in its creative action, it knows by omnipotent self-consciousness all that is latent within it and produces and governs the universe of its potentialities by an omniscient self-energy. So its self-awareness is also self-productive. All the potentialities within it are ordered, composed by an awareness which is omniscient. There is no lapse in consciousness. There is no interruption in conscious being. This creative action of the all-existent has its notice in the fourth, the intermediate principle of supermind or real idea, in which a divine knowledge, one with self-existence and self-awareness, and a substantial will, which is in perfect unison with that knowledge, because it is itself in its substance and nature, that self-conscious self-existence, dynamic in illumined action, develop infallibly the movement and form and law of things in right accordance with their self-existent truth and in harmony with the significances of its manifestation. Sri Aurobindo has added that last phrase, and in harmony with the significances of its manifestation. And the movement he has described as infallible, also a word which he has added, because here he's describing the action of this organ of knowledge will, which we call the supermind, which is in oneness with Satchit Ananda. He says that this all existent, this being which we call consciousness, existence, bliss, has a notice. A notice is a knot or a knob or a lump. It means that here, at this point, something appears. So in this infinite existence, consciousness, and bliss appears this notice. And through this notice comes all else into being. The infinite potential, the conscious support, and the all-supporting bliss come into expression through that. But it is self-conscious. It is a self-existence. And the law of its movement, because it is built on consciousness and knowledge, is infallible and results only in the harmonious expression of itself. It establishes an order within its own being, in which things shall be done, because it pleases it to be so. And because it is in accord with the nature of truth, those orderings become, in a sense, the regnant laws operating within the supramental conscious being. So all is a harmony. All is ordered. There is no irregularity. There is no disharmony. There is no imperfection. The infinite has not been lost in the self-expression of the supermind. He goes on. The creation depends on and moves between the biune principle of unity and multiplicity. It is a manifoldness of idea and force and form, which is the expression of an original unity, and it is an eternal oneness which is the foundation and reality of the multiple worlds and makes their play possible. So this oneness from which all comes does not lose its oneness, its singularity in being, because it manifests itself in infinite variegated ways. It remains unified. And that oneness is what makes the many possible. Supermind, he writes, therefore proceeds by a double faculty of comprehensive and apprehensive knowledge, proceeding from the essential oneness to the resultant multiplicity. It comprehends all things in itself, as itself the one in its manifold aspects. And it apprehends separately all things in itself as objects of its will and knowledge. So it is at once the continent in which all occurs and maintains an all-awareness of all of that, and yet can reach out in and through its distributed manifestation and find the truth and will behind each objectification of that knowledge. Each is willed to come into being. Nothing accidentally occurs. All has the conscious support and directive of the innate wisdom of the supermind expressing the infinity of Satchit Ananda. So while to its original self-awareness, All things are one being, one consciousness, one will, one self-delight, and the whole movement of things, a movement one and indivisible, it proceeds in its action from the unity to the multiplicity, and from multiplicity to unity, creating an ordered relation between them, and an appearance but not a binding reality of division, a subtle, unseparating division, or rather, a demarcation and determination within the indivisible. So you see that here in the supermind, though this variegation occurs, which is an expression of Satchit-Ananda, the multiple who are expressed are not really divided from that one. They know themselves to be more than connected, to be actual expressions of only that one being, that only that one being exists. So we might say that there is definition of this, there is definition of that, but there is no division between this and that. He concludes the paragraph by saying, the supermind is the divine gnosis, which creates, governs, and upholds the worlds. It is the secret wisdom which upholds both our knowledge and our ignorance. So here he's reaching both above, back to the Satchit-Ananda from which it comes, and below as the secret wisdom which governs even this world of ignorance, which he will shortly define for us again as that which is a method of self-forgetting in cosmic expression, which results in mind, life, and matter as we know it, but does not confine them to that. In other words, what seems to be ignorant now need not always be so. Not only can awakening mind enlighten itself, but confined power can unharness itself, and the forms of matter can liberate themselves into the freedom of the full reality and identity back with being. So far, then, he's described Satchit-Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, and the nature of the supraliminal manifestation of Satchit-Ananda. He continues, we have discovered also that mind, life, and matter are a triple aspect of these higher principles, working so far as our universe is concerned, in subjection to the principle of ignorance, to the superficial and apparent self-forgetfulness of the one in its play of division and multiplicity. And this is what ignorance means, simply self-forgetfulness. We get lost in the division, in the multiplicity, and forget the one from which we come. At least that kind of self-forgetfulness is possible to the mind, not to the supramental, but to the mind there can be this self-enclosure in a particular form, in a particular pursuit. Really, he says, these three are only subordinate powers of the divine quaternary. Mind is a subordinate power of supermind, which takes its stand in the standpoint of division, actually forgetful here of the oneness behind, though able to return to it by re-illumination from the supramental. So mind is, in a sense, a faculty of the supermind meant to support the principle of division so that distribution occurs, gets lost in that distribution, but is capable of re-illumination or rejoining the supramental action and play through the supramental, re-illumination from the supramental. So it is not something that it can get itself, but has in a sense, the implication is here, that the supramental must in a sense reach down and lift it up, which means mind must be receptive to it. That's the first part of the sentence. Life is similarly a subordinate power of the energy aspect of Satchitananda. It is force working out form and the play of conscious energy from the standpoint of division created by mind. So mind takes a standpoint of division, and then life, in a sense, empowers and informs that, gives structure to this vision or template that the mind has created. Matter, he writes, is the form of substance of being which the existence of Satchitananda assumes when it subjects itself to this phenomenal action of its own consciousness and force. So when substance says, yes, I will agree to this, then it is formed into this manner. It assumes this form of substance. It is not locked into it. So we have seen then that Sat, Chit, and Supermind have distributed themselves as matter, life, and mind. He writes, in addition, there is a fourth principle which comes into manifestation at the notice of mind, life, and body, that which we call the soul. Again, a notice where mind, life, and body meet. Huh, there is a knot. There is this knob. What is it? We call it the soul. But this has a double appearance, he says. In front, the desire soul, which strives for the possession and delight of things, so it's out here trying to find satisfaction and externalities, no? To possess, to own something, and thus to experience and find delight in it. That is the desire soul outside. And behind, and either largely or entirely concealed by the desire soul, the true psychic entity, which is the real repository of the experiences of the spirit. So there is this notice in where mind, life, and matter meet. In the front is this desire soul, which we think to be our real being, but behind is a secret psychic entity, which is our real self, the real core of our individuality. But let's not forget the point. He continues, and we have concluded that this fourth human principle is a projection and an action of the third divine principle of infinite bliss, but an action in the terms of our consciousness and under the conditions of soul evolution in this world. So, a very pregnant sentence there. So, what is our true soul is a projection of this divine bliss into the action of the cosmos operating under the conditions of the world as we find it. The one is a projection of the other. for the purpose of establishing individuality in the cosmos. But bliss is not simply an individual affair. He continues this paragraph by saying, as the existence of the divine is in its nature an infinite consciousness, and the self-power of that consciousness, so the nature of its infinite consciousness is pure and infinite bliss. Self-possession and self-awareness are the essence of its self-delight. The cosmos also is a play of this divine self-delight, and the delight of that play is entirely possessed by the universal. But in the individual, owing to the action of ignorance and division, it is held back in the subliminal and the superconscient being. On our surface, it lacks and has to be sought for, found, and possessed by the development of the individual consciousness towards universality and transcendence. So the cosmos has this experience as a whole in the cosmic consciousness of being embedded in this bliss. This bliss is in its nature self-existent. It doesn't have to look for itself outside. But in the cosmos, there's an extension of that as well. But in our being, since as individuals we are working according to the conditions of the ignorance, it is lost to us in our surface existence. In the way we normally meet life, we don't find it, so we're looking for it. We're looking for satisfaction here. We're looking for it there. We're looking for happiness. We don't get it much, nor do we ever taste the inalienable bliss, which is our real nature, but it is there when we discover our subliminal depths, our real nature behind, the true mind, the true life, the true body that we have, and in our superconscient being, that which ranges up back to our supramental home. In these places, we have access to those seas of bliss as they are expressed on every plane of being. But in the surface, we do not. And it's good because it keeps us moving. We are restless and always trying to find it. So we have to keep growing. We have to keep moving forward. We must keep evolving until we can experience that bliss and become captives of it. When we rejoin the cosmos, we can transcend all limits in terms of our manifest being and in terms of that in us which is unmanifest and ever unborn. We may therefore, if we will, pose 8 principles instead of 7. And then we perceive that our existence is a sort of refraction of the divine existence in inverted order of ascent and descent, thus ranged: existence, matter; consciousness, force, life; bliss, psyche; supermind, mind. The divine descends from pure existence through the play of consciousness, force, and bliss, and the creative medium of supermind into cosmic being. We ascend from matter through a developing life, soul, and mind, and the illuminating medium of supermind towards the divine being. So we see here the telescoping of Satchit-Ananda through the creative supramental into cosmic being, in a sense, occluding or burying itself behind the veil of matter. And we ascend back from matter, first through life, then through an emerging psychic presence, then through mind, and what illuminates them all, the supermind, towards divine being. So this is an important sentence because it shows you that soul, as soon as life is here, begins to manifest itself, begins to take charge and drive the enginery upwards towards the goal. Because these seven principles of existence, matter, life, mind, ananda, chit, sat, are all meant to be experienced by this questing soul, which is the principle of bliss, stationed to support the cosmos, but also articulating itself through every growing individual. Every spark of bliss arcs upwards, but carries all with it as it grows, leaves nothing behind. So, we're talking about this division between that and this. The knot of the two, the higher and the lower hemisphere, is where mind and supermind meet with a veil between them, Parardha and Aparardha, the upper half and the lower half. So there is a veil between mind and supermind. Otherwise, if it were not there, mind could look up and remember what it is and say, ah, I forgot. How did I get all divided like this? Let me reconstitute myself and become one with you again. But that veil is there. So even at the tops of our mind, penetrating that veil requires an act of real focus and will, an enlargement. The rending of the veil is the condition of the divine life in humanity. For by that rending, by the illumining descent of the higher into the nature of the lower being, and the forceful ascent of the lower being into the nature of the higher, mind can recover its divine light in the all-comprehending supermind. The soul realizes its divine self in the all-possessing, all-blissful ananda. Life repossess its divine power in the play of omnipotent conscious force, and matter, open to its divine liberty as a form of the divine existence. The rending results in the liberation, then, of all nature, all the planes of involved being. It requires that step, that conscious ascent of the mind as articulated in the human into that region of supramental light, which is governed by harmony, governed by unity. And if there be any goal to the evolution, which finds here its present crown and head in the human being, other than an aimless circling and an individual escape from the circling, if the infinite potentiality of this creature, who alone here stands between spirit and matter with the power to mediate between them, has any meaning other than an ultimate awakening from the delusion of life by despair and disgust of the cosmic effort and its complete rejection, then even such a luminous and puissant transfiguration and emergence of the divine in the creature must be that high uplifted goal and that supreme significance. So, if our current difficulties in the cosmos are all that we get, and this is an aimless circling, and only an individual escape is the way out, it seems that the cosmos would be meaningless, because there is a cosmic ground, a universal ground of being in all of these planes, which are part of this endeavor. And if we were to quit and find an individual moksha, a liberation, or annul our being into a blanked out state of nirvana, then we would leave the cosmos precisely as it is, in this aimless whirling, this circling. But we have the power, as he writes here, we are the only being which can mediate between spirit and matter. And if we do this, if we achieve this rending of the veil, if we break the lid which separates that upper half from the lower, if we can connect the aspiring human consciousness with that infinite consciousness above, then that radiance can pour itself down and transfigure all that we experience here. And the hidden divine here can emerge. Matter, life, and mind will show and demonstrate a nature that is concealed to us now. They are not forever darkened by ignorance unless we lead them so. But in us, that powerful impulse to exceed ourselves is that divine will which pushes us forward first through desire and ego, and then finally through an awakened soul, to complete this quest. Get to the top of this hill and reach up. He continues, but before we can turn to the psychological and practical conditions under which such a transfiguration may be changed from an essential possibility into a dynamic potentiality, we have much to consider. For we must discern not only the essential principles of the descent of Satchitananda into cosmic existence, which we have already done, but the large plan of its order here, and the nature and action of the manifested power of conscious force which reigns over the conditions under which we now exist. In other words, we have to grasp what is the ultimate plan, what is the order of emergence, and we have to understand what our current condition is better. So there are coming considerations, which means, what do we do to achieve this higher consciousness? But first, we have to take stock of where we are and where we're going before we talk about the how. At present, what we have first to see is that the 7 or the 8 principles we have examined are essential to all cosmic creation and are there manifested or as yet unmanifested in ourselves in this infant of a year. Back to the citation above, the calf, which we still are, for we are far yet from being the adults of evolutionary nature. Evolution then is just beginning. We're in our first year. Nice to know it. The higher Trinity is the source and basis of all existence and play of existence. And all cosmos must be an expression and action of its essential reality. No universe can be merely a form of being which has sprung up and outlined itself in an absolute nullity and void and remains standing out against a non-existent emptiness. So Sri Aurobindo has asserted again that from Satchit Ananda as the foundation of all, from positive being, this universe stands out as a manifestation of it. And this is contradictory to the standpoint of Buddhism or of extreme schools of Vedanta and even Western nihilism, which would assert that we arrive out of non-existence, that there is a void at the bottom of all. He utterly rejects that notion. He continues, it must be either a figure of existence within the infinite existence, who is beyond all figure, or it must be itself the all existence. In fact, when we unify ourself with cosmic being, we see that it is really both of these things at once. That is to say, it is the all-existent figuring himself out in an infinite series of rhythms in his own conceptive extension of himself as time and space. Moreover, we see that this cosmic action, or any cosmic action, is impossible without the play of an infinite force of existence, which produces and regulates all these forms and movements. And that force equally presupposes, or is the action, of an infinite consciousness, because it is in its nature a cosmic will determining all relations and apprehending them by its own mode of awareness, and it could not so determine and apprehend them if there were no comprehensive consciousness behind that mode of cosmic awareness to originate as well as to hold, fix, and reflect through it the relations of being in the developing formation or becoming of itself, which we call a universe. So here he has set the table and said, existence is both of these things, an infinite existence above and beyond all existence, which figures itself here. How does it do it? Through an infinite force. Why does it do it? Because it can. Does it do it unaware of its own nature? No, it is completely compelled by its own will. It does it because it can, because it wants to. And supporting all things with its comprehensive consciousness, it also apprehends all things moving within it and establishes all the relations of being. So here he is articulated again, Sat as existence, Chit as conscious force, and to come, Ananda, bliss. And we'll save that bliss for next week, except that we'll claim a little bliss of our own in reading of Savitri. And we'll continue with that same passage where we were last time. We were in the book of the Traveler of the Worlds, if you remember, and the world stare. Once in the vigil of a deathless gaze, these graves had marked her giant downward plunge, the wide and prone leap of a godhead's fall. Our life is a holocaust of the supreme. The great world mother, by her sacrifice, has made her soul the body of our state. Accepting sorrow and unconsciousness, divinity's lapse from its own splendors wove the many-patterned ground of all we are. An idol of self is our mortality. Our earth is a fragment and a residue. Her power is packed with the stuff of greater worlds and steeped in their color lusters dimmed by her drowse. An atavism of higher births is hers. Her sleep is stirred by their buried memories, recalling the lost spheres from which they fell. Unsatisfied forces in her bosom move. They are partners of her greater growing fate and her return to immortality. They consent to share her doom of birth and death. They kindle partial gleams of the all and drive her blind, laborious spirit to compose a meager image of the mighty whole. The calm and luminous intimacy within approves her work and guides the unseeing power. His vast design accepts a puny start. An attempt, a drawing half done, is the world's life. Its lines doubt their concealed significance. Its curves join not their high intended close. Yet some first image of greatness trembles there, and when the ambiguous crowded parts have met the many-toned unity to which they moved, the artist's joy shall laugh at reason's rules. The divine intention suddenly shall be seen. The end vindicate intuition's sure technique. A graph shall be of many meeting worlds, a cube and union crystal of the gods. A mind shall think behind nature's mindless mask. A conscious vast fill the old dumb brute space. So, until next week, namaste. Jai Ma.